Right, we're going to continue with Zechariah. We're up to section 16 on the prophets of the restoration as we survey Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. We're in chapter 10 of Zechariah. In the last chapter, what we saw was a chapter that was largely chronicling the the estate of the Jews between the time of the rebuilding of the temple, which is the time when Zechariah is prophesying, and the coming of Christ into that temple. And in fact, there are a couple verses in the middle of the chapter that focus our attention on this coming in great humility. Chapter 10 is a chapter that's going to pick up and very clearly has a dependence on the previous chapter. But chapter 10 is designed to answer some questions that have to do with the nature of the struggle and how the Jews are going to move forward in this. Chapter 10 is really, in some sense, a bit of a hinge prophetically, in that there's both prophetic material, as we're going to see. In fact, I think some very impressive things are being discussed in this chapter about the restoration of the Jews, and I think it has to look beyond any kind of restoration that occurred at the time of the return from captivity, the Babylonian captivity. It's clearly looking beyond that. In fact, it's clearly looking beyond any spiritual application that we might have with respect to the Jews, for example, at the first or earliest portion of the Christian era, that idea of to the Jew first and then to the Gentile. Okay. The fact is that if we look at what's being said about the restoration of the Jews, there's going to be a lot, and I'm going to point that out when we get to that part of the chapter. There's a lot there that I think demands a different point in the prophetic horizon than just, say, the first coming of Christ. There's something more going on there. Chapter 10, in fact, because of this juxtaposing of ideas and its proximity to this account of the Maccabees, I think invites us to consider whether or not the Maccabees have the whole event that we said refers to the Maccabees, if there isn't something typical of this restoration of the Jews when we're looking for that at the end of the Christian era, prior to the millennium, sometime prior to the millennium, that there might not be something instructive there. I think there is. And I'll point out a couple of things along the way. Again, chapter 10 is of interest because chapter 11 is going to move us very solidly, in many respects, into the Christian era. And it begins to paint a picture of early Christianity, and even pointing us again beyond. We're talking about the early and the latter reign, which is going to come up in the very first verse in this chapter. We're talking about themes. We're talking about types and antitypes. We're talking about prophecy and fulfillment. We're talking about prophetic horizons where there are increasing degrees of fulfilling, where there is a plenary effect as each prophecy unfolds, or as each ripple in this fulfillment unfolds, we see the prophecy being fulfilled, not only type and antitype, but we see as it moves into the New Testament, it takes on an entirely new dimension of fulfillment. So if this Old Testament building of the temple is a type pointing to an antitype, which is the millennial church, then we've got to look at a lot of the language and see that it is symbolical with respect to this. And so a good deal of this is going to be, although it occurs historically at the time of the Maccabees, there's a lot of it which is really symbolical of what's going on in the future, what will go on. And that, again, is borne out by the nature of the prophecy that we're going to see at the end of chapter 10. We're going to see it. This is not a prophetic vision that's sort of terminating with the Maccabean revolt and establishment of Jewish rulers under the Maccabees, which, in fact, only really lasts until about 60, 65 years before Christ. So we want to begin at verse 1. There's only going to be one or two verses outside of Zechariah 10 that we're going to look at this time, but there are a fair number of points, I think interesting points to consider as we move through chapter 10. So, verse 1.
Zechariah 10, verse 1. Ask ye of the Lord rain in the time of the latter rain, so the Lord shall make bright clouds and give them showers of rain to every one grass in the field.
So the previous chapter, that has a prophecy that really takes up the estate of the Jews from the rebuilding of the temple until the coming of Christ. It raises a question, a different question, and that's really what's dealt with in the first few verses of this chapter, and that is this: how do we obtain the promises of God? Right, we know now that there's this promise that the Jews are not going to be utterly dispersed or dispossessed. Certainly that temple is going to survive until the coming of Messiah. How do we obtain these promises? Well, we're told in verse 1 to ask of the Lord rain in the time of the latter rain. The latter rain is the rain that fell in March to ripen the harvest. Now, their growing season is a little different where they are. It's more around rainy and dry seasons, and so in the fall, what we would call the fall, sometime around October, you'd get the former rain, and that would moisten the ground. It was a good time to plant seed. The latter rain is the rain needed to bring seed that's been planted to full harvest. And we're going to return to that theme in this chapter. But I just want you to lock that in your mind. They're being told to pray for the latter rain. Now, I've already alluded to the fact that not only is the early rain and latter rain, is it a type and antitype, the Old and the New Testament, but it also has bearing on the early church and the millennial church. That there is this rift, and there are actually features of prophecy respecting what will happen at the latter rain. And while we can say that there is an anticipation in the early church and in the converting of the Jews at that time, the number that were converted, the language that's being used is much more pervasive. And just as there's sort of this little literal fulfillment forming the type, in antitype, the fulfillment of a lot of this stuff is going to be, in at least in certain respects, more literal. Okay, it's going to take on a little bit more of a literal character. So God wants to be entreated for this latter rain. He wants his people to cry out to him for the blessing that they're going to need in order to bring about the harvest. That is important to remember. Again, we're going to come back to this when we get to the latter part of this chapter and start talking about the converting of the Jews. But we're going to see where that latter rain becomes important, when this idea of harvest comes in. So what we're shown here is something like this. Man is being presented as very needy and needing to call upon God for supplies from heaven. And although in terms of the imagery being used, the clouds might withhold their rain, through prayer, that's not going to be the case. The Lord is going to make bright clouds and give them showers of rain. So through prayer, they're going to serve the needs of man. And in fact, the verse indicates the Lord is going to have respect to all that call upon him, even in what might seem to be the least of necessities. That is, even their beasts are going to be supplied with grass in the field. So the preparation that we're to expect here, I think, is being presented as something which is top to bottom. It's going to be very pervasive preparation. So the chapter then begins with an emphasis upon the connection between prayer and promise. What we can derive from this is that in a certain sense, the promises of God are dependent upon the prayers of the people of God. And when God's going to do something, he moves his people to pray. If people are praying for something, you can pretty well be assured it isn't going to happen. When he is intending to do something, he does it in answer to the prayers of his people generally, and that means he moves them to do it. So that he's trying to move them to pray to this end. All right, verse 2.
Zechariah 10, verse 2. For the idols have spoken vanity, and the diviners have seen a lie, and have told false dreams. They comfort in vain. Therefore they went their way as a flock. They were troubled, because there was no shepherd.
So, why is it that the prophet is admonishing the Jews to pray to God? I think very simple. Very simple answer to this. Fact is that prior to Babylon, the Babylonian captivity, the Jews had tried a lot of different avenues of relief, right? They really didn't stick to their monotheism. They didn't stick to the true God. They were very quick, in fact, a lot of times, to try any new faddish thing coming down the road. You know, some pagan shows up with some fad religious practice, and it would probably have gotten a hearing from the Jews. They were not very circumspect when you read the prophets and the way that they were walking. There's a lot of idolatry going on. There's a lot of false doctrine being taught. That's, if you remember last time, that's going to go away. And a lot of this is going to go away with the coming of the Maccabees. You know, once they come back from Babylonian captivity, the Jews really don't ever again show this propensity to idolatry. But here we're seeing this is one of the things that has to go. It has to be taken out of the way. Now, the point here is, if you're listening to the prophecy, look, these things did not work very well in the past. In fact, they didn't work at all. And they're not going to work going forward either. You're not going to get out of that. So what's mentioned, idolatry and astrology, the diviners, they all stand together condemned as contrary to the promises of God. In fact, again, as I say, it's very clear, if we consider the history of the Jews, that they've been made subject to vanity again and again, because of idolatry. God has driven them before the face of their enemies. And it finally ends up, they're in this horrible Babylonian captivity until God calls a number of them back to the promised land. The net effect is this. During this time, this, and you see this in the verse, that they went their way as a flock. That is, they're made to wander like sheep without a shepherd. That's the language. Why is it Jesus is talking this way when he shows up? Sheep without a shepherd. This is a result. They're in this horrible predicament because of their idolatry. And even though they've given it up by this time, they're still not really over it. The effects, the consequences. Yes, it's gotten better with the Maccabees, but it's still not all that it could be or should be. So the fact is, if we understand this, people who renounce the true religion and embrace what is essentially false religion are going to meet with miserable disappointment. They're going to be troubled like sheep without a shepherd. They're going to be left to wander. They're going to be left to their own devices. That's why you need to pray. And pray specifically. Pray for that latter rain. Right? Verse 3.
Zechariah 10, verse 3. My anger was kindled against the shepherds, and I punished the goats. For the Lord of hosts hath visited his flock, the house of Judah, and hath made them as his goodly horse in the battle.
And here we see that the result of all this praying, and it's going to become a little bit more apparent in the next verse as well, that there is at least a preliminary fulfillment in this Maccabean revolt. That the Maccabees are really sort of just over the horizon from this kind of prey. They've been made to wander. They're back now. They're building the temple. Are they going to remain in this state where they really just have to wander like sheep without a shepherd? No. Right, verse 3, we see the focus of the anger of the Lord is against what are called the goats or the he-goats among the sheep of his people. Now, the reason for the term he-goats are speaking about the leaders of the people. The he-goats are the goats in the flock, generally, that are leading the flock. When you want to get a flock to go somewhere, you strategically drop a few goats that are going to follow you, and then they follow, you know, all the rest of the sheep follow them. So they're leading the flock from place to place, the he-goats. What they are really are the wicked rulers in the church and state. And God is essentially saying, look, I'm angry with you. You know, my people are wandering like sheep without a shepherd, and here you are, you're like he-goats in the flock, but you're not leading them wherever you want to go. And he's saying he's going to punish them. He's going to visit them. The term visit here means literally he's going to punish them. He's not just going to stop in, you know, and say hello, let's have some tea together. This idea is more serious, which is why it's translated punish. So the ones who are first in sinning against the Lord, which is usually the way it is, the leaders are the ones who cause the people to err, they're going to be first in suffering punishments. He's going to punish them. He's going after them. Now, interestingly, involved in this verse is this idea that the same God who's directing this judgment on the he-goats is going to visit or have mercy upon his flock, the house of Judah. Right? And he promises, and this is very interesting, he promises that instead of them behaving like timid sheep who are being led around by whoever, you know, and this can work in a lot of ways. A lot of times what they did is they would find a couple of your brethren. They would give those people kind of the cushy job And their job was to convince you to go along peaceably and do whatever your conquering force wanted you to do. Comply, work, you know, move forward, whatever the cause is that they have. But instead of pretending or behaving like timid sheep anymore, they're going to be made out like goodly war horses. And the word goodly is actually referring to their ornamentation. They're going to be decked out for war, prepared for battle. And this verse, I do think, is pointing both to the Maccabees and beyond, but its first point of contact is really going to be with the Maccabees. And again, that's borne out, I believe, when we get to verse 4. So let's look at verse 4.
Zechariah 10, verse 4. Out of him came forth the corner, out of him the nail, out of him the battle bow, out of him every oppressor together.
Okay, so what what's being predicted here is a time coming, and this is key, it's future to when Zechariah is prophesying, a time when the rulers are going to come forth from the house of Judah. They're not going to come forth from the presence of foreigners. You know, the king of some foreign nation isn't going to set up their rulers anymore. And these people that come forth are going to be like cornerstones or and nails or pins, all of which is the language of construction. So they're being pictured as a building that's being built up, kind of like the temple. Cornerstones, pins, being built up into this structure. The structure they're being built into is the theocracy, which is going to rest upon what they're doing. Now, the latter part of this verse, I think, refers, at least in the first instance, to the Maccabees. They're military deliverers. Out of him, the battle bow. Out of him, every oppressor together. They're military deliverers who rise up from among them. The Maccabees are a family that basically decide they're going to go to war. It's worth going to war. They're going to wage war, and we saw in the last chapter that there was a promise that they were going to win. Now, in this respect, this verse is speaking to the victories and restitutions of the Jews before Christ. Nonetheless, I think we need to take the longer view, particularly in light of the context of chapter 9, that we're heading for the Messianic Kingdom, in context of chapter 11, where we're going to be discussing that Messianic Kingdom in a little bit more detail. This idea, out of him, the battle bow, out of him, every oppressor together, appears to be pointing to the conversion of all Israel, because ultimately that self-sustaining energy of the Messianic Kingdom is going to eventuate in the converting of the Jews and their grafting into the church again. So this is where it's going. Now, I say that it may not be entirely obvious in this verse, but in the context of this chapter, I think we have to go there. In the context of this chapter, there is this idea coming about the Jews being restored and converted and all of that. So the idea of someone coming forth, the corner or the nail, That language is language of establishment, the building, the language of the battle bow, and out of him every oppressor together. That kind of language is talking about the conquering, the overcoming of the Maccabees. In that, there's a vision of that New Testament era when the church is going to overcome. I want to look now at verse 5.
Zechariah 10, verse 5. And they shall be as mighty men which tread down their enemies in the mire of the streets in the battle. And they shall fight because the Lord is with them, and the riders on horses shall be confounded.
Yeah, so the Maccabees, in some sense, are shadowing forth the conquest of the chosen people of God. We're told here that they trample their enemies in the mire of the streets. And, in fact, this happens to a large extent. What happens is when Antiochus and his armies, cavalry, they come into Jerusalem, the Maccabees rise up and pretty well do just that, trample them into the mire of the street. But again, this kind of language is looking forward to the spiritual conquest of the church, when the church is said to tear down the mighty strongholds of the devil, subduing principalities and powers. All right, it looks forward to the time under the New Testament when the Jews are converted. Why? Because they shall fight because the Lord is with them. In other words, and this is where we start to see that we have to have a little bit more enlarged vision. This is not simply a national conversion, or I should say restoration of the Jews, but there's a conversion going on if the Lord is with them. You know, and that's what we're told is the case. That's the language of reconciliation. That's the language of people who are in covenant again. The Lord is with them. So they have a bit more going before them. The Lord is with them. They're no longer just naturally Israel, but they profess a true religion, right? So they've been grafted in. And so again, I see eschatological tension is sort of brought forward here in the remainder of the chapter. There's a tension between the already and the not yet, between the old and the new, between the early and the latter reign. There are all these tensions going on. But here we see this tension of this verse involves in its resolution what we can essentially refer to as the converting of the Jews. All right, verse 6. Zechariah 10:6.
And I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph, and I will bring them again to place them, spread mercy upon them, and they shall be as though I had not cast them off. For I am the Lord their God, and will hear them.
And here is, I think, the beginning of a very detailed description of what we would call the conversion of the Jews. And it goes like this: as God is going to strengthen the house of Judah, so he's going to convert and rejoin the 10 tribes of the north. This is not a one-sided event. This is an event that is going to require that there be all of the different tribes being brought back in. The language here of bringing them again to place them, right? What do you mean, bringing them again? Well, bringing them is saving them. And again is talking about what Paul talks about in Romans. They're going to be grafted in again. Right? They were cut off for their unbelief. They're going to be grafted in.
So you're saying that the 10 lost tribes will be rediscovered?
They're going to take part somehow. They're going to be involved in this restoration. It's the house of Jacob and the house of Joseph, which is another way of saying the house of Ephraim, which is going to come up again. And so they're there. They're going to be taken in. In addition, I will bring them again to place them. Now that language, this is exactly the kind of language that has led a number of people over the years to not only to assert the converting of the Jews, but also to assert that they would be converted to their own land. They would be brought back, reestablished in their own land. That idea, as well as taking away all the signs of his anger, which is what really is involved, I think, in this idea. You know, if God is restoring the Jews and he's converting them, well, remember, their dispersion, what they call the diaspora, that's the result of God's judgment on them. So if the judgment of God is being removed, if there's that impediment is no longer there, then they're going to be placed again in the land where they once were. If they've got that going for them. So, even though it's in the distance, the fact is, this prophecy concerning the future of Israel is very much in some sense connected with the Maccabean deliverance, because it's foreshadowing what happened with the Maccabees. It's foreshadowing in some sense the conversion and restoration of the Jews prior to the millennium. Now, the prophet is placing all of this stuff, in a sense, side by side, in order to allow them to be seen as distinct, yet not unrelated fulfillments of one prophetic revelation. It's not really talking about a bunch of different things. All of these are talking about God's covenant faithfulness to the Jews, their restoration, in fact, their planting in their own land. Right? But the Maccabees, for the first time in a long time, the Jews assume occupation and control of Palestine. If we look again at the language, for I am the Lord their God and will hear them, we also see here that all of this, converting and restoration, is evidently predicated upon the idea that God is a covenant-keeping God. I am the Lord their God and will hear them. Right? This is, he's the God of the covenant-making God, and he's going to hear them. He's not going to turn them away. All right, we're going to move on to verse 7.
Zechariah 10, verse 7. And they of Ephraim shall be like a mighty man, and their heart shall rejoice as through wine. Yea, their children shall see it, and be glad, their heart shall rejoice in the Lord.
And this is, again, we're in this section of the chapter now talking about the conversion of the Jews. And this promise in verse 7 seems to be directed particularly to the 10 tribes. I think it's a little, there's some significance here, right? they're going to be brought again and made to have common cause with the Jewish church. And they're going to find in this consolation, which is described as being the kind of consolation that people have when they drink wine, right? When they've had a little bit of wine and they're starting to feel confident, they're starting to feel as if they're really at the forefront of a cause. You know, they get a little bit of an elated feeling from that. The fact is, the 10 tribes are going to be brought again as well. And it's important at this juncture, probably for Zechariah, to raise this and really to underscore this point, because the fact is, at this time, they still had not returned from the captivity, and they may well have required some special word in order to encourage them. Now, although this point that's being made in this verse, and even to some extent in the previous verse, although these things pertain spiritually to all Jews converted down through the ages, this once more, I think we have to say, is pointing to a church of Jews and Israelites after their conversion, and by the way, prior to the millennium and the second coming of Christ. It's something which we're told is going to be awaiting a future fulfillment, at least when Zechariah is writing. If we look again at the language used here, their children will see it and be glad, their hearts shall rejoice in the Lord. That language is the kind of language we would come to expect when we're talking about people who are talking about people who are turned in such a way that they've been taken into covenant again. That there's this, we see the descending obligation. They've been removed from this sort of smiting. You know, part of the problem is here with these dispersions of the Jews to the four winds of the earth, they're going forth cursed of God, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago. They're carrying that curse with them wherever they go. But this language of your children singing and being glad, heart rejoicing in the Lord, this is really language that is looking forward, A, to the New Testament era, and B, particularly to the millennium, when the people are going to be established in that truth. Again, we'll see as we continue in this chapter that there's something more in view. It's not just an isolated thing that's being talked about here. It's not just some individual minor or relatively minor event in history, but it's something more pervasive and more interesting than that. Look at verse 8.
Zechariah 10, verse 8. I will hiss for them and gather them, for I have redeemed them, and they shall increase as they have increased.
I will hiss for them and gather them. With all the talk about the restoration of the Jews and their conversion, Jews and the Israelites, that idea, how hard is this going to be, has to be addressed now. So how hard is it going to be for God when the time comes to call them all back together? He's saying it's going to be as easy as when a shepherd gathers his flock with a hiss. It's sort of like going out and you whistle. Right? You you whistle, and your animals, a lot of times you can get animals to come running toward you. All right. There may well be, and this may account for the particular word that's being used here for hiss. The image might actually be taken from an apiarist, beekeeper. Evidently, beekeepers, in order to get the swarm to move, they can do this by either hissing or whistling. And so that's a possibility. You may have gotten that imagery from a bee, beekeeper. The idea is this: regardless of what we take to be the exact reference at this point, the idea is that this restoration of the Jews and their conversion and all—it's not going to be hard. For God, this is not presenting some major difficulty. In fact, here he gives, I think, a pretty good reason why he's going to call them again. He says, I've redeemed them. He paid a price for this elect people. In this restoration, he declares, in fact, there's going to be an enlarging of his promises. And I think this idea, they shall increase as they have increased, this idea of an enlarging when they're going to be returned and restored, probably is pointing to an increase both as to number of actual converts as well as the expansive nature of the New Testament church. It's very important to see, I think, in this a forward look. This is beyond whatever happens during the time of the Maccabees. There's an enlarging. Whatever we can say about the Maccabees, and there are a number of positives there, the Maccabees don't really represent they don't really represent an enlarging. Right, there's even in the early church when the Jews are being brought in, that doesn't really represent an enlarging. That kind of enlarging, particularly you see when the church begins to grow outside of Israel. All right, we're going to look now at verse 9.
Zechariah 10, verse 9, and I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children and turn again.
Look at the language here. First of all, this verse is telling us this dispersion of the Jews is not accidental, it's by design. God has deliberately scattered the Jews. And we're told they were sown like seed awaiting the time of their germination. Right? They were sown. Well, this again takes us, why are we praying for the latter rain? What's really in view? The sowing, and if you remember, the sowing that's in view here is not any previous diaspora of the Jews. The sowing that's in view here in this portion of Zechariah is actually when the Jews are dispersed at the time of the fall of Jerusalem, when the temple's cast down. So that's the time of the former rain. That's when they were sown. The prayer here is for the latter rain, for the rain that accompanies the harvest. And so we're moving now from the early church, really, in our contemplation, to the time sometime prior to the millennium, where the Jews are going to be converted en masse. We're looking for that harvest. We're praying for that. Which again is why, why are we so interested in the Maccabees? Maccabees are in some sense presenting us with a type this gathering and regathering at the end of the New Testament era prior to the millennium, that is, in fact, an antitype. They're being sowed like seed. Now, this also, I think, points us to a certain vitality which is in existence in the consciousness of the Jews. A mindset that's so interesting that when they're converted, they're very likely going to take great interest in extending the true knowledge of God wherever they go. Now, we want to remember the synagogues in the early church were a very special means of publishing the gospel, propagating the true religion, and even getting it out to the Gentiles. Imagine what it's going to be like when the Jews are converted. Imagine what it's going to be like when they're grafted in again. We're told by Paul that their conversion is going to issue in the bringing in of the fullness of the Gentiles. We want to look at Romans 11, verse 15.
Romans 11, verse 15. For if the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead?
Paul says, listen, when they are in fact reconciled at that time, it's going to be for the Gentiles like life from the dead. Why? Well, if they're cutting off was to the benefit of the Gentiles. And remember, they're cutting off at 70 AD is really being compared in these prophecies to the time of sowing. They're being sowed among the nations. Right. This regathering, reconstituting, restoration of the Jews, this is something which is happening at the end of time. The end of the time minus the millennium. So just prior to the millennium. And this is all part of the plan of God, which is, again, this fits very much with what Paul is teaching in Romans 11. Right? So just as they were instrumental in the spread of Christianity in the first instance, it looks like they're going to have an interest in the spread of Christianity at the time prior to the millennium. Now, unlike every other time, you know, they kept having troubles, right? The Jews would have problems, they would repent, God would take them back, they would grow complacent, and they would find themselves cast out. In the final clause here, and if we go back to verse 7 to a certain extent, these two places in this chapter, I think among other things, are pointing to what we could call the permanence of the conversion of the people. They and their children are going to be grafted in to be cut off no more. It was a very common feature prior to this. Jews, they get right with God, God brings them back, then they start doing something bad, God cuts them off. The point is that they're going to be converted prior to the millennium, and there's no reason to think that they're going to be cast off, cut off, or in some other way thwarted, you know, during the millennium, or really any time after. The Jews are going to be converted, it looks like, once and for all. It's going to have great effect on the Gentile nations. Now, the extent of this conversion and the radical nature of the conversion are really being held out in the next two or three verses as we approach the end of the chapter. Verse 10.
Zechariah 10, verse 10. And I will bring them again also out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, and place shall not be found for them.
If it wasn't clear before, I think we have to confess, and we've seen this in some of the other prophecies in Zechariah, that the gathering that's in view is not from the Babylonian captivity, but it has to be from some later dispersion, some wider dispersion, one that, as I said, is going to occur after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. It's the language of a verse like this that confirms to us that we're looking beyond whatever immediate prophetic horizon is available to Zechariah. Right? We're looking beyond the Babylonian captivity here. In fact, the language of the prophet doesn't even make sense if we think that we're talking about Babylon. Now, Egypt and Assyria in this verse are taken as types of the lands into which they're going to be dispersed. Do you have any idea why? Does anybody have any thoughts as to why it might be Egypt and Assyria? Egypt was the first land where Israel as a nation has to go down and they're going to suffer affliction, they're going to suffer oppression. So they're the first land of oppression. Assyria, the Seleucid Empire, and all that they're facing at this time is really the most recent from Zechariah's point of view. So Egypt to Assyria, Egypt and Assyria, that language is really sort of an A to Z. Everything that you've experienced in the life of your nation, your church, all of that is going to be comprehended in this verse as being this is going to be the typical situation that the church has faced. And yet what he's pointing to, and this is I think key, he's pointing to something future that's going to make all of these other dispersions sort of look like probably a minor events, and probably in terms both of time frame, like how long they're there, and even as far as how widely distributed. So in the Babylonian captivity at that time, they're much more widely distributed, for example, than they were when they were in Egypt. In Egypt, they're all kind of in the land of Goshen, waiting until God redeems them, but they're scattered throughout the Babylonian Empire, and when, you know, even up through the time of the Greeks, they're all over. This is a broad dispersion then.
Egypt to Assyria to the world.
Yeah, it's sort of hinting at that there's a much wider, broader thing. The other thing about this language, right, keep in mind, Egypt is in the south, Assyria is in the north. So this is not only is it a first to last, but it's a north and south. There's almost a little bit of idea of a compass. They're all over. What we're told is this, that when they're returned, and again, the language here is very important language, because we've already seen that it appears that they're going to return to their own land. And now, in this verse, we're told, in essence, they will. But they're going to return. They're going to occupy the entire land of promise. So Gilead and Lebanon actually represent the utmost borders. Lebanon to the north and Gilead sort of to the east. They're going to fill in everything. You know, this is a problem. They never quite took possession of the promised land. But in the restoration of the Jews, when they're converted, they're going to take over all of that. It all belongs to them. It's all their stuff. It's all their land. And look now at verse 11.
Zechariah 10, verse 11. And he shall pass through the sea with affliction, and shall smite the waves in the sea, and all the deeps of the river shall dry up, and the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away.
And here we're talking about, if we're talking about the extent of the diaspora in the last verse, now we're talking about this, what's involved with their conversion and restoration. And it appears, actually, that there are going to be some pretty big impediments in their conversion, right? So there's going to be a great deliverance wrought. It's actually likened unto their passage through the Red Sea. So the restoration of the Jews is kind of being likened unto that. The sea itself represents, as it's pretty apparent in the language, I think, it represents the affliction that's going to proceed. But smiting the waves, you might not be so clear on that. You smite the waves, and what happens is they're made quiet. So it appears it's going to start out with affliction. But just like God carrying Israel through the Red Sea, as they're being delivered, there's going to be a smiting of the waves. That is, the Gentile nations that are sort of taking maybe shots at them. And it's going to quiet them. God is going to quiet them. He's going to smite the waves. He's going to stop them. So the way for the conversion and restoration of the Jews is going to be opened up. When they were delivered from Egypt, remember, the waters of the seas and of rivers were dried up as they marched into the promised land. And here, we're given this idea, just as God brought down the pride of Sennacherib and Belshazzar, that's really what we're talking about with Assyria and Egypt, right? Or when he drowned the Pharaoh in the sea, there's Egypt. So we have Assyria, we have Egypt. The deliverance that God is going to work in this effect is going to be in such a way that no one is going to be sitting back and saying, is God on their side? There's going to be a great display of divine power on behalf of the Jews when God converts them. They're going to move from a state of affliction, a state where they're sort of going to be under some kind of serious afflicting, in all likelihood, to relative calm. God's going to put down all opposition. And ultimately, like you have with Sennacherib or Belshazzar or Pharaoh, those who are resisting the return of the Jews will probably be completely destroyed. Right. That's the language that's being used here. So again, why are we combining this with the previous chapter? The previous chapter is about the Maccabees, but the Maccabees are really a type of what we're talking about in this chapter. It's really preparatory to this time shortly prior to the millennium. But verse 12, I think, is really the definitive verse for understanding why we need to see this in terms of the conversion of the Jews. So let's look at verse 12.
Zechariah 10, verse 12, "And I will strengthen them in the Lord, and they shall walk up and down in his name, saith the Lord."
Yeah, "I will strengthen them." That language is talking about conversion. Right? "When thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren." Right? That language is conversion language. Look what's said here. "The Lord will convert them in the Lord. I will strengthen them." I is who? The Lord. "Will strengthen them." How? In the Lord. "And in his name they're going to walk up and down." That is, they're going to be in their own land. They're going to occupy their land. They're going to walk freely in their land. The Lord is going to convert them in the Lord. That's the language of Christianity. Unless there are two Jehovahs. Unless we're devolving into polytheism, then there is this idea of more than one person in the Godhead here. They're going to become believers in Christ. They're going to take upon themselves his name. They're going to be called Christians. And in this, they're going to place their confidence and trust, both they and their children. Remember, this is going to be a permanent situation, a permanent solution. They're going to be brought into the faith. They're going to be made to believe. They're going to be Christian. So chapter 10 is, first of all, a prescription for praying the promises of God. But it's really focusing on why should these people building the temple, ultimately, what is their concern in all of this, looking forward? Yeah, the Maccabees are an assurance the temple is going to make it to the time of Christ. But now we're being told in chapter 10, something that we were told earlier in the book, that there's going to be a time when the Jews are going to be converted and restored. And the building of the second temple, well, in some way, this is informing that event. So they're being encouraged to build the second temple by looking forward thousands of years to some future conversion of the Jews. They're being asked to consider something that's very far down the line. If they pull themselves out of their immediate danger, their immediate concerns, this should be a relatively worthy endeavor, right? If I know that I could do something that's going to save the nation of my people. Think about that theme in the Old Testament, how many times people are concerned to save, the people, the Jews. The whole book of Esther is based on this idea. Now, this is not an unfamiliar theme. And it's going to carry a lot of weight. Remember, Esther's going on at the same time as these Jews are building the wall and the temple and all the things they're doing. Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther are all right around the same time. Right. So next time, what we want to address, and we want to get into chapter 11, we're going to go into that, and we're going to begin to see a lot more of this prophecy and its fulfillment in terms of the New Testament, or the new administration of the covenant of grace when Christ comes. So that's what we're going to look at next time.